Well, it's unquestionable that we live in a secular age. What I mean when I say secular at this point is not simply a lack of religion, which is a more historic meaning of the word secular. It's akin to the idea of even like laical, just related to something other than the clergy or the particularly religious. But secularism and secularity has grown pretty significantly in recent decades, to the point that one author, I think it's Charles Taylor, argues that we live in a sort of third world where we went from everyone believing to it being sort of needed to be warranted to believe, where now we live in a world where unbelief is assumed, generally speaking. Now, I'll be the first to say that, and I think McLaughlin clearly agrees with this if you read the book Flout, that the decline of religion in the world has been greatly overestimated. But that's not to say, though, that the tides of secularism have still nonetheless impacted the way we think greatly. One book that I would have made you read is a book called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman. And it is absolutely fantastic book that kind of helps us understand how we got to where we are. But the reality is that the default assumption for a lot of people in the West, and I understand we're insulated to this from this to some degree in Gadsden, Alabama, but probably not as much as we'd like to think. But the impulse that most of us have is to not believe rather than to believe. Sort of reminds me of this story I heard one time about a strip club that opened up next to a church. And the church wasn't happy about it. You know, obviously they're not happy about that. And everybody's like, people from church can see us going in now. Anyway, I'm just kidding. No, they're not happy. They don't want that next to their church, you know. And so they start praying. They pray every Wednesday night and every Sunday that this, you know, horrible place will close. And then several months later, the strip club closes. And later, the church secretary gets a letter, and it's a subpoena letting them know they're being sued by the strip club for causing them to close. They prayed and closed the strip club, right? And so they finally get to trial, and they're before the judge, and the strip club owner says all that they say, and the church pastor and leaders come up, and they say, we had nothing to do with this strip club closing. And the judge says, let me get this straight. We've got a strip club here that believes in the power of prayer and a church that doesn't, you know? I think all of us, right, even those of us in the Lord's church, right, are more secular than we think we are. We have less faith than we think we have at times. We have more doubt than we realize. With all that being said, nonetheless, despite James K. Smith, a writer and philosopher, said it like this. He says, we're all Thomas now. We're all doubting Thomas at this point. Charles Taylor, a philosopher, says that we live in what he calls a haunted world. In other words, the thing about secularism is that nobody quite believes it, right? It's always found lacking. And I noticed over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the way that this idea of hauntedness is bubbling up all around. You know, horror movies aren't going away. I actually last week during Ask Anything Wednesday talked about this, that there was somebody in the in our church whose friend believed they had a ghost in their house, you know, and how would I answer that? And I said, well, you know, one of the things that we would sort of just, things don't go bump in the night, you know, it's kind of our initial reaction, right? I don't believe in ghosts, but I do believe things go bump in the night, right? And I don't think they're ghosts. One time the alarm went off here at the church. And I'm first on the alarm call list by choice. I just think it's just one of the things I do because I love my staff so much, you know. And so just trying to make their lives easier all the time. So If it's 1 a.m, the alarm goes off, I get the call. So if one of you jokers throws a rock through a window or something, if you try to get me out of bed, I'm going to be real mad. I come up here one night, and it's the middle of the night. The cops come in. They start clearing this facility down here. And I don't know if y'all have ever been in First Baptist Church in the middle of the night. I don't believe in ghosts, and I'm not scared of demons, no kidding. But I get a little nervous in here. You know what I mean? Just makes me a little nervous. Well, I'm real nervous when I think somebody might be in the building. You know, I'm a lover, not a fighter. The cops come through and they clear the building, and then I'm a nervous wreck, and they're like, man, there's nobody in here. We don't see anybody. Everything's fine. And they put their guns up, and that's when I start to relax, you know? I notice a couple of them seem to be tensing up a little bit. And he looked at me and said, hey, y'all ever seen like a ghost or anything in here? And I was like, I'm feeling good now. You know, there's no robber in the place, you know, and I'm feeling real good. I didn't have a gun. You know what I mean? I didn't even bring my Bible with me. And so I said, no, man, there's no ghost. There's no such thing as ghosts. Now, there might be a demon, you know. And he did not think it was funny at all. The reality is, I do find it funny, you know. We were scared of different things and at different moments. Sometimes even as Christians, right? When somebody talks about believing in a ghost, we roll our eyes so hard that we miss that we do really live in a spirit-inhabited world. And as secular as we want to be and as materialist as we want to be, we cannot, as human beings made in the image of God, escape the reality that we live in a spiritual world. And this is the sort of thing that a Taylor or Smith would call hauntedness, the hauntedness of the world. Smith said it like this: we don't believe instead of doubting, we believe while doubting. And that's the truth. By the way, I would just say sometimes we treat doubt in the Lord's church like it's just the worst thing in the world. Like, how in the world? One time I talked to someone about some doubts I was having, and they said, why in the world are you having those? You know? And I was a teenager, and I said, I guess I shouldn't. I don't know. I just want to ask these questions. And, you know, at 14 or 15, I thought, well, he's just not smart enough to answer them. And, you know, that's kind of what goes through your mind. And so you start to think there aren't answers to my questions. I'm supposed to just, you know, close my eyes and pin the tail on the donkey and hopefully it sticks. But the reality is, right, that we have to be careful to realize that for Christians, doubts are like antibodies for us in so many ways. Tim Keller said to doubt your doubts, something I wholeheartedly agree with. But also don't be afraid of your doubts. Don't shove them down. Don't act like you can't ask them. Don't be ashamed to confront those things. The reality is all of us have more doubts than we even probably want to admit. There's a band I love called the Postal Service, and Smith actually quotes them to help make his point about doubt. And the Postal Service said it like this: I want so badly to believe that there is truth, that love is real, and I want life in every word to the extent that it's absurd. So this is a secular band. It's the guys from Death Cab for Cutie's kind of side project. And even then, they're like kind of crying out into the void, right? I want to believe truth. Truth is that there is truth and that love is real. And so these guys, Smith, help us understand Taylor, goes on to say that there are cross pressures in our society. And I think about this a whole lot as I think about y'all, pray for y'all in the world in which you live. I recognize, and I it didn't dawn on me until just a few years ago, but I recognize I live in a little bit of an ivory tower, right? I work at a church. I spend a huge, maybe too much time around Christian people. You know, I think about it sometimes that as a pastor, I need to try to find a way to spend more time with lost people, you know? And maybe they'll open something by the church. Not a strip club, but something, you know, we'll see. And maybe I can meet some lost people. But, you know, I spend a lot of time around Christian people. So it's very rare that I speak up about my faith and people are like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know what I mean? If I'm invited to be on a board in town or something like that, it's usually because they need a pastor slot, you know? And they're like, I know one, you know? It looks like he can tie a bow tie. Let's see, you know, maybe he can do something. So nobody's ever surprised by that in a way that I know many of you struggle with these cross pressures in a much more pronounced way than I do. There's the pressure of the hauntedness of the world. There's the pressure of secularity. There's the pressure of all these varying belief systems around us. And they make it harder and harder to believe in our modern age, and it's a struggle. It really is. And let me just say, if you're not struggling with doubt, that's okay. Like, I don't want anybody here to. And if you're not struggling with doubt, it's okay that you're in this class. I think you can still be blessed. Several years ago, I listened to this interview with Tim Keller, and somebody asked him if he, what was the last big doubt he had? And he said, well, I mean, I'm a pastor, I've been a pastor for a long time. Tim Keller's with the Lord now, by the way, but then he said, a few years ago, I read through The Resurrection of the Son of God by N.T. Wright, which, by the way, is just this massive tome on the resurrection. And he said, as I was reading it, I learned things in that book that revealed doubts I didn't even know I had. You know, that I had questions answered that I didn't even quite realize I was asking. So some of you may have an experience like that. It happened to me. I read this book called The New Testament. What's it called? The Peter Williams book. You know what I'm talking about, Jake? There's a Peter Williams book about the New Testament. I'm going to quote it later, so we'll talk about it. And it's red, and it's got tan. Anyway, I can't see it. Anyway, so long story short, it's a great book. And as I was reading it, I thought, I think I know what Keller was talking about now. You know, I felt great. I was like, I'm a little like Tim Keller today. And maybe I'll be smart someday like him. But I remember thinking like, man, this is answering questions I didn't even realize I had. I just felt doubts answered that I didn't really even fully realize I had. I read a collection of short stories by an author named Lauren Groff. I don't think she would call herself a Christian. I wouldn't call her a Christian, you know, based on the testimony I see from her life. But I read this book. To try to understand the world in which we live. How about this? If you want to understand the world in which you live, let me tell you a good place to go. Okay? One, Walmart. Okay? Number two, the waiting room at a pediatric clinic. All right? These are places that are no respecters of persons. All right? There's not a fancy Walmart and a not fancy Walmart in Etowah County, you know? And there's not the fancy pediatrician and the not fancy pediatrician. Everybody's going to the same places, right? So you can see the world as it is, which I think is good to do. The third place I think you can go is a bookstore, okay? It's sort of like Amazon, but if somebody put it inside some walls, okay? But they only had books. All right, so go in a bookstore. I love bookstores. One of my favorite things to do. My wife and I both love bookstores, love going to bookstores. We travel, we seek out bookstores. If you're going somewhere soon, send me a text, and I could probably recommend a bookstore if somewhere I've been. We like to do that. So one of my favorite bookstores in the world is actually in Jackson, Mississippi, Lemuria Books in Jackson. It's a great bookstore, and that one, there's Octavia Books in New Orleans that I love. There's Parnassus in Nashville. Thank You in Birmingham's wonderful. There's a couple in Atlanta I like to go to. But I in particular like to go to Southern bookstores because it kind of gives you a little bit of an idea. Bookstores in the South give you a little bit of an idea of what people who are generally more secular leaning are reading in the South in particular. So somewhere like Lemuria is really helpful. I'll even go to their website from time to time just to kind of get an idea of these novels. So Lauren Groff is a really popular author. I've read a couple of her books. Another book I read several years ago was by an author named Jesmyn Ward, who's actually from Mississippi. And interestingly enough, I say all this to say, interestingly enough, I've just seen this sort of hauntedness bubbling up in literature. And in the books that the sort of secular elites in the South are sort of presenting as really great literature as well. I say all that to say that Groff wrote this collection of short stories called Florida that I loved. And there's one story in there called Flower Hunters. And it's told from the perspective of a lonely, struggling wife and mother on a Halloween night. And that's important because she talks about how there are these little ghosts and ghouls that are running by the house all night, right? So you see this kind of hauntedness. Seeing Unburied Seeing is the Jesmyn Ward novel I wrote. I'm afraid I'd spoil it if I talked about the ghosts in that book, but it's really good. So the character in this short story, she's become obsessed with an 18th century naturalist named William Bartram, who explored Florida and wrote about a lot of the flora and fauna in Florida. And she commends him she comments on him throughout the course of the story after sharing all the things she's afraid of. And she says, he was a gifted and perceptive scientist who also believed in God, which seems a rather gymnastic form of philosophy. She misses believing in God. And I feel like there's just such a sense of, just in a little sentence like that, right, of what we've lost as a culture. That for her, the idea that someone could be a scientist and believe in God seemed crazy to her. By the way, there's more than you think. But then that idea, she misses believing in God. For many of us as Christians, maybe one more thing we want to do in this class, right, is to grow in our compassion for our more secular-leaning neighbors, right? We always treat people who don't believe like it was just some simple choice they made, right? They just decided, they just said, I'm going to curse God and die, you know, move on with my life. That's not always the case, my friends. There are people who want to believe. I've talked to them. I've prayed with them, who want to believe in God, who long to believe in God, and just can't seem to bring themselves to do it. And so it is sad to live life without the Lord. You were made and meant to know him and love him and enjoy him forever. And so I hope we'll have compassion toward our lost and our more secular-leaning neighbors in all the things they believe, by the way. I don't mean that we agree with them, right? But we can have love for those who disagree with us, and I hope can look upon them with compassion. It would be a lot like what our Lord Jesus Christ did. And so I think that's important. Doubt, then, these ideas, I think, are what characterize our secular age. Doubt is the basic assumption of modern man. But there's still some room for something else, right? I miss believing in God. I love reading articles, or I'm fascinated by articles that I see them all the time about people in a secular age trying to figure out how to replace things that faith gave previous generations, right? So you'll have singing clubs that come up, or all, but anything but a church, right? And it's like, I don't know if you've ever seen those memes where it's like anything but a backpack day at school or whatever, you know? And so it's like anything but a church day, you know what I mean? We're doing goat yoga now. I mean, that's where we are. So, you know, anything but church. And so so doubt's the basic assumption of modern man, but there's still some room for something else. There's doubting, of course, but there's also the inescapable haunting of the world we live in. It's just constant barrage, not only of secular and there is no God, but also the constant barrage of, man, there's got to be more to life than this. You know, it's kind of, I just thought about this. There's that song, even something as seemingly inane as the Barbie movie, right? And there's that song in, you know, Barbie's trying to figure out, is there more to life than this? And, by the way, yeah, I'm confident enough to say I've seen the Barbie movie, you know, and, I've got no problems with it at all. And, but I think Billie Eilish sings is it Billie Eilish? Who's willing to say? Jamie nodded his head enthusiastically. Just so the record's clear, it was Jamie Meredith, says he. No, I think it's Billie Eilish that sings the song. And she's like, what was I made for, I think, is the chorus to that song. So even then, right, there's something more. There's an inescapable haunting to the world that we live in. There's some things that our secularity just can't comprehend. It just can't explain. It makes no sense why we would cry at the Grand Canyon, right? Friends, I wanted to tell you something this very night. Woodrow Turner cried at the Grand Canyon, okay? Woody, that works here, Woody Turner cried at the Grand Canyon. It's one of the three times he's cried in his life. And so he got teared up, right? I mean, there's something that even someone with the absolute hardest heart I know, I'm just kidding, but like, you know, Woody, like, not Mr. Emotional, right? He stands at the Grand Canyon and gets teared up. I've over the years thought about dabbling in stand-up comedy, and one of the bits that I've been workshopping, but this is why I haven't done it because it's not funny, but it's just a thought I've had, is like, you know, imagine like Neil deGrasse Tyson at your kid's first birthday party, right? And he's like an astrophysicist that just tries to burst every bubble in the world, you know, And he's like, that's not amazing. So, you know, it's like, congratulations, you know, this humanoid creature has made it one lap around the sun, big whoop, you know, or whatever. And but all of us know, right? The most secular person in the world is still like moved at the thought of a baby being born. It's beautiful. There's just something going on. There's a ghost in the machine. And so I really do believe there's a sense in which we're all Thomas, that we're all doubters. And yet at the same time, we all feel a burden to believe. And so I'm just saying, I'm trying to give you guys just a sense of how I'm thinking about the world as we come into this class and dive and delve into a lot of different issues. So with all that being said, kind of my understanding of secularism, and by the way, it'll change over time. The data changes so frequently on these things. But there is a rising tide of secularism, and it's here in the Southeast as well. Maybe as time goes on, we'll even hopefully be able to work out some specifics on exactly what it means to think secularly or to be in a sort of mode of doubt. But let me just say, for the sake of this class, with all that being said, let me just give you a real simple sketch of my approach to defending the faith. Okay? So here's sort of my approach and my mindset. So you sort of know as we go through this class, all right, this is where Matt's going. So if any of you are note takers, you can write some of this down and make sure I talk about it all. But if there's something compelling, I forget or something. But my basic approach starts with this idea. Can we reasonably believe, this is where I start. This is a weird place to start, maybe you might think. This is where I start. Can we reasonably believe that Jesus' contemporaries were convinced of his resurrection? All right? That's step one for me. Can we reasonably believe that Jesus' contemporaries were convinced of his resurrection? By the way, let me just hit the pause button there. I'm going to come back. I might need to tell you a little bit about my own biases and the way my brain works. I maybe should have mentioned more of this to begin with. I'm sort of a natural skeptic. My wife is not like that. She's just was precious the day she was born, you know? And she heard the gospel and she got saved when she was 9, and that was that, you know? And she's like, I've never had a day where I wondered if there was a God or not, you know? And sometimes I'm like, I never had a day when I didn't, you know? And I kind of say some of this stuff tongue-in-cheek, but I was talking about our choir musical and how beautiful it was and just the soaring that. And a friend that knows me well enough to know that this was a joke, I said to him, I said, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm so moved in the middle of it. And I was like, I think there's a God. I'm pretty sure there's a God. You know, this doesn't make sense to me unless there's a God, right? So I say that to say, I'm convinced now, clearly. I don't sit around all the time thinking about whether God exists. Except to say that, I mean, there really is a profound sense in which to this very moment, I'm either a robust Christian like I am, or probably something like an agnostic. There's not a lot of middle ground for me. I don't have much for a sort of milquetoast via media on faith. So if it were, you know, for me right now, if you ever hear like, you know, not that I'm leaving the pastorate necessarily, that wouldn't necessarily mean that, but I just mean, for me, I'm either like profoundly believing the gospel and that's what makes me believe in God, or, and we'll talk about that later, but, or I would probably be, I don't think I'm quite at atheist level at this point in my life. I think it takes too much suspension of things for me to be an atheist, but I might be something like an agnostic if I weren't a Christian. So I say all that to say, so my brain is, it torments me, okay? This is the perfect background music for this, Gene.
Really good.
Try Diet Coke. It's delicious and makes you feel good, eh? No, my brain sort of torments me in some ways, in the sense that I can't just take anything at face value. And I'm in a constant and literal constant debate with myself over almost everything. So my wife is always like, are you talking to yourself right now, babe? Because, you know, my mouth's moving and it's clear I'm talking to myself. And I said, no, I'm arguing with myself. It's very different. And And so everything for me, I'm sort of like, okay, but what if I didn't believe this? How would I feel about it? If I was a skeptic, like, so if you kind of hear the way I think and see this, maybe you'll see flavors of that tendency in this. And I may make you mad before this class is over because I will push back, okay? I'm not going to let, you may leave here with some simple answers, but you won't leave with easy ones, okay? So we're not, no pat answers. We don't, some of you take my classes, you know, no pat answers in an Alexander class. We don't do that. Maybe there's a sense in which I'm like, you know, I thought about lots of different things I wanted to do, and I feel called to be a pastor, love being a pastor. But there are other things I thought I might like to do, including being a professor. So maybe I'm just pretending to be a professor here. I don't know. But all that being said, you'll notice that sort of razor that I kind of run everything down by nature. I'm a natural skeptic. So if you're sort of like, why would we start here? It's just where I feel like over time arguing myself and talking to people who aren't Christians, it feels like the most logically sound way to go. So can we reasonably believe that Jesus' contemporaries were convinced of his resurrection? If so, if that's the case, so what I would just, if I'm talking to somebody that doesn't believe, I would say, if you can say that, we can reasonably believe that. Not that we're 1,000% sure, but is it something someone could reasonably believe? If that's the case, then the New Testament is at least an accurate portrayal of how early believers viewed Jesus as the risen Messiah. It's at least that. Because if you believe, like if you can come to the conclusion, and I'll make an argument for this. If you can come to the conclusion that Jesus' contemporaries were convinced of his resurrection, right? Then what you can say about the New Testament is not necessarily that it's true. All the secular things that could be said about the New Testament could still be said. But a point I would want someone to be able to concede is this, that the New Testament is at the very least an accurate portrayal of how early believers viewed Jesus as the risen Messiah. Now, if somebody says there's no way anyone around Jesus actually believed he raised from the dead, or Jesus doesn't exist, or whatever, I mean, that person is so far out to lunch. I mean, it's at that point, their history is so poor and so jaundiced and so influenced by whatever that it's really hard to reason at that point. So, if number one is true, corollary one, if the New Testament's at least an accurate portrayal of how early believers viewed Jesus as a risen Messiah, then if that is true, then my next question is the New Testament reliable? And for me, maybe of all the evidential type apologetics questions that there are out there, the reliability of the New Testament, to me, is the closest thing we have to a slam dunk. And I think we've got a week coming up where we're gonna, why do Christians trust the New Testament? That's like 2 weeks from now, right? So I'm gonna give you some reasons why I think the New Testament's reliable. God bless you if you're the kind of person who's like, because it's God's word, you know what? God bless you. I love you. You make my job so easy, you know? I'm not one of you, okay? I'm the one that's like asking somebody like, this doesn't make sense to me. Can you explain this and this and this and this? And so I'm here for those folks, you know. But yeah, I've always been committed for a long time to having sort of ministry where we could reach and love and serve someone who really struggled with doubts. So that's important to me. Okay, is the New Testament reliable? And so we can talk about that. And then question number three is this that I want to ask. Is Christianity compelling? Is there any sense in which you want it to be true? Okay? Now, here's the thing. In the West, everyone wants it to be true, whether they realize it or not. The craziest thoughts that you hear out there in the kind of secular world they owe something to Christianity. Everybody owes something to Christianity. You know how our culture talks about how wonderful love is all the time? You know? By the way, we are descended from people who did not talk about love all the time. Y'all know this? This is not something the Vikings were interested in. You know? This is not something the Romans were. You know, the Romans were interested in virtue exclusively. We care about morality, right? That's a Christian idea. Now, virtue is important, but you can't have Christian virtue without morality, right? You can have Roman virtue without Christian morality, okay? So the ancient Romans could practice all sorts of crazy things. You know, a Roman man, citizen, could treat almost any slave or servant. I think one author says they could treat them sexually with as much ease as today someone would use a urinal. That makes us uncomfortable to think about, but that's the difference. Right? They talked about virtue. It wasn't virtue in a Christian sense. And again, you know, you don't have societies and cultures who talk about the triumph of love and all this different kind of stuff, you know? And where did that come from? It came from the Bible. Now, as we become more secular, right, we're detaching some of the ideals of Christianity from the morality of Christianity. And worse, from the lordship of Jesus Christ, right? But a lot of the debates we have happening in modern society are simply one aspect of Christianity divorced from the lordship of Christ versus another aspect of Christianity divorced from the lordship of Christ. Okay? And the whole picture. So I do like to show the way that Christianity is compelling. And I then, over time, try to demonstrate that the thing you already like is compelling and the things you don't like are more compelling than you think they are. And you actually don't want one without the other. So McLaughlin has a chapter on hell. So a lot of times, you'll have people say, well, I love the idea of God being love, but I hate the idea of judgment or hell, right? Which, by the way, I don't have like a hell poster on my wall in my office, you know, all the time, just pumped about it. It's hard. It's difficult. It's heavy. But what I'll usually do with someone like that is start talking to them until I find somebody they do think should go to hell. Because everybody has somebody they think should go to hell, right? And then I would say, you bigot, you know? You're terrible. You think Hitler should go to hell, you know? Who are you to judge Hitler? And then they're like, well, of course I judge Hitler. And I'm like, by what standard? You know, you just kind of walk from some of these sort of things and say, well, you hate the idea that there's not somebody out there that's going to make somebody like Hitler pay, okay? Now, we can debate hell over here, but you don't hate it as much as you think you hate it. That's the point that I'm trying to make. You don't want everyone to get off scot-free. I usually don't have to get to Hitler, by the way. You start thinking about people you think should go to hell, and you won't get to Hitler either, right? We're all pettier than we think we are. No kidding. So I start asking these questions about, is Christianity compelling? And then, you know, part of that is sort of like, well, how's not Christianity working out for you? Is it doing for you all that is it keeping all its promises? Is it doing for you all it says it's going to do? And then I want to point people in still under number three, is Christianity compelling? And show them that which is true and good and beautiful finds its yes and amen in Jesus Christ and his gospel. That all of our desires are wrapped up in Christ. And so I want to show that. So that's part of what we're going to be talking about, is truth, looking to truth, goodness, and beauty. I think truth, goodness, and beauty is sort of a really important apologetic. And I think the most important context for us presenting the faith is the context of loving Christian community. We'll talk more about it as time goes on. Okay, here's my last thought. I'm trying to remember. I guess next week we may talk about some of the arguments for God's existence. And I'm going to tell you something that's happened in my life. My least favorite is now my favorite. Okay? So since I was in college, I had to study just, you know, I was a double major in college in theology and humanities. So I think most of you know my dad's a car dealer. So I came home and I said, Dad, guess what? Like, I'm adding a second major. And I know him well enough, and I was able to say, I was like, a lot of my classes count for both, and then I've still got X amount of electives to finish, and if I just take certain electives, that'll count toward my other major, and I'll have two majors. And he was like, so it doesn't cost me any more money. He's like, no more money. No extra money. It's a two-for-one special, in fact. It's a BOGO, you know? And he said, all right, that's great. He said, what's your new major? I said, humanities. And he said, okay. He said, well, tell me a little more about humanities. I said, you know, it's like history and philosophy and English and humanities. He said, oh, so still nothing you make any money with, right? And I was like, that's right, yeah, that's true. And so I say all that to say, since college and theology and humanities and seminary, over the years, I've had to study the different arguments for God's existence. And I won't go through all of them now. I think we may talk about them later. But my least favorite used to be what philosophers call Pascal's wager. Some of you, I know one or two of y'all at least are teachers. You've probably heard of Blaise Pascal, who's a famous mathematician. But what you might not know is he was also probably an even better theologian, theological thinker. And Pascal was kind of a sickly guy, but he was prolific, brilliant. He set out to write what I think would have become the greatest book of Christian apologetics ever written. I mean, I know that sounds crazy. I really think it would have been. But he died before he could finish it. So all that was left were his notes. And so he basically had this file folder that had all these strips of paper with writings on them, and each of them have a number. And he'd made an index and had there's like a loose kind of structure of how he wanted all these ideas to come together, right? So that book is called the Pensées, P-E-N-S-E-E-S, and there's an apostrophe or two in there. I don't know French. So the Pensées is just, most people read it like a collection of proverbs. And in the middle of this collection of proverbs is this argument called the wager, okay? And in most of the way the wager's told, I hate the way it's told, and it's really frustrating, and it's oversimplified, and it's taken out of the context of Pascal's work, because people wouldn't know what context it should be read in unless you've read one of the books that helps you understand what he was trying to say overall. But here's the core of the wager. Basically, Pascal is having a debate with someone. I like to know that he argued with himself as well. He's having a debate with himself on paper, and he says to the secular guy, you know, if you're right and I'm wrong, there's no God and there's nothing after we die, I've lost nothing, right? But if I'm right and you're wrong, you've lost everything, okay? And usually when people talk to you about Pascal's wager, right, it ends there. And can you guess why I've hated it? I hate it right now, where it is right now. Because it's just twisting somebody's arm, right? You know, if I said, hey, come to First Baptist Church, I'm going to run you over with my car. You'd probably come to First Baptist Church, right? You know what I mean? If I see you out in town, I'm going to run over you in my car if there's no cops. It's not hard to convince someone like that, right? That's not real heart change. But people miss the rest of the wager. What Pascal says to the guy is, why wouldn't you take that wager? You're crazy not to. So you have to admit that there's something at work besides pure reason that keeps you from believing. Right? Now that takes it from something I hate to something I adore. And something that it took a long time for me to get into my heart. I hated it once I understood what it meant for a while as well. You know why? Because I wanted to believe that I could convince someone through reason to be saved. But guess what? I can't. And you can't. You know why? There's something besides reason at work that keeps us from believing, not trusting in Jesus. You see, what Pascal believed was that there was something going on in our hearts, that it was sin that kept us from believing. And again, if he could have finished his book, it wouldn't have been called Pensées, because that just means sayings. I don't know what it would have been called. But if he could have finished his book, I think we'd all agree that it was brilliant. I say all that to say, I am so moved now over time to remember that God has to do the work. And maybe the best thing we can do is help people see it's not pure reason that keeps you from believing. And there's some things. So we never let go of the heart. It's the point that I'm trying to make, right? We always focus in on the heart. We always focus in on the gospel. And I think Pascal helps us remember that. We have to be careful to not develop an over-reliance on evidence or the mind, right? Now, does the mind matter? Yes. Do we want to give real answers to real questions? Yes. There's a guy I knew years ago. I was still in college, I think. He was older than me. He was already an attorney, but went to the same church and was serving at the church he went to. And he was just telling me, he went to the church. He wasn't a member. His wife is a member. He wasn't a believer. And I remember him one time, we were talking, and he said, I'd answered a million questions. You know what I mean? Like, just so many questions. And he always found him compelling. He's a really sharp guy. I mean, it was good for me. He was a great sparring partner. I loved it. We're still friends. But I say all that to say, one day he said, there's just part of me that thinks at some point, like, if God wants me to believe, he'll send me some kind of sign. He'll show me something. I was like, man, dude, like, what do you think I am? I was like, if a year ago, it's like, hey, some, you know, kid with chubby cheeks from the University of Mobile is going to come on staff at your church and answer every question you've ever had, and you're going to find them compelling and everything else, and then you're going to just keep getting answer after answer after answer your question. And, like, would you not have felt like that was something God was doing? So this doesn't make any sense apart from God being at work, you know? I was like, I've told you, I struggle with some of the same stuff you struggle with, right? And I did wind up baptizing him. But I just say all that to say, like, the point wasn't just this over-reliance on the evidence of the mind. Eventually, right, you can answer every question in the world, and somebody's still like, I just feel like God might do something, you know? And I'm like, he's answering your dang questions, you know, through me. I mean, he's got the answers out there. And anyway, so that's something we have to be careful with. We have to be careful that we don't win the argument and lose the person. And that maybe leads into just some carefulness we need to have as Christians in general. It's hard to live in a world where people don't generally agree with us and our faith. And for a lot of us, it's taken some getting used to, right? I'm kind of used to it. I'm 40. I'm a man. But I'm 40 years old. I kind of grew up with it sort of being like, you really believe that? I mean, I've had people, a lot of people just say, do you really believe, like, you really believe that? And so I'm kind of accustomed to that. I mean, not every friend I grew up with would still claim to be a Christian, right? I'm sure it's the case with a lot of us, but I'm more used to living in Babylon than I think my parents are. And people younger than me are even more used to it, right? It's hard, and I can feel like as we look and we see people collectively sort of losing their minds a little bit. I get it. I'm no defender of the sort of decadence of the age, okay? But we have to be careful not to have a real shrill witness. I was a bit of a rascal growing up. And I'll tell you who I like to behave for. I like to behave for the teachers that played it cool. You know? Is everybody with me so far? But I'm going to tell you who me and my friends loved to not behave for. The ones that like to scream with their voices real high at us. You know what I mean? The ones that you could get stirred up the most. Because that is fun, okay, when you're a rascal. Now, I don't condone it. And if I find my boys doing it, you know, I may have to find a new job, right? Because I'll whoop their tails. Just like I got in trouble for being ugly at school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm trying to say is, right, sometimes I feel like we're making ourselves good, like bad sport. Like we're making ourselves easy targets by just freaking out about every little thing. It's okay to sit back, close your eyes, say Jesus is Lord, and just keep hoeing the garden. You know, just keep plowing the ground. Just keep going on. Now, do we have to have steel spines? Are there moments where we must speak the truth? Unquestionably so. But sometimes I feel like we're doing a lot of hooting and hollering as Christians. And it's oftentimes at the expense of us being able to reasonably give a reason for the hope that's within us. Now, I've got friends who are going to say, Matt Alexander's one of these guys. Thinks we're going to win some people into liking us. And, you know, if we're just winsome enough. No, I mean, listen, secular people are going to hate Jesus. And if you hate Jesus, you're going to hate me, I hope, you know. I hope I'm not like the seven sons of Sceva, you know, that when people hate Jesus, they're like, I know Jesus and I know Paul, but who's Matt Alexander? Yeah, I hope I'm known among the haters, okay, of Christ. I hope I rank there. But what I'm saying is, so are there moments? Yes, of course. But I do feel like at times what the world knows from us more than anything is a sort of shrill judgment and not a cautious, sober-minded, careful critique, yes, but a loving critique and an invitation to know and love Jesus. That's what I'm going for. So do I think we need to bow down to the spirit of the age, et cetera, et cetera? What? No, I don't. You know, if somebody goes and finds this recording or whatever, they probably won't listen this far. They'll go find the little juicy bits that sound like I'm trying to be a squish and give in or something and whatever. No, nobody cares what I think. But, you know, I mean, like, no, I don't think we just give in, right? I don't think that. But I don't think that hooting and hollering all the time is going to do what we think it's going to do. So that's kind of my approach. That's how I think. And so that's part of what it means for us to never abandon the heart. We're here to win hearts for Christ. Does that involve winning minds? Yes, it does. Does that involve at times breaking down arguments and replacing them? Yes, it does. Does that require steel spines in a secular age? Absolutely, it does. But we're still here to try to win hearts with the gospel of God's grace. All right. Any questions, y'all?
What is it, 7?
6:59, Jane.
I'm a little bit concerned about some things I'm seeing on television now that use the word religion and prayed up. There's some celebrities on TV that talk about praying, and they're being serious about it. And then the term Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they're thinking when they say those things. I wonder.
I'm not sure that they do either, Jane. And I mean, I really mean that some of those terms are things that are so over the board. I'll tell you what, we don't have time to talk about Christian celebrity culture or Christian nationalism tonight. But before this class is over, maybe there'll be a week when I finish a little short, or I think it will come up in some places. Short answer, I'm a big fan of saying we need to keep preaching the gospel and giving clarity, but at the same time, just like Paul says, whether in truth or in pretense, right? So long as Christ is preached, I'm happy. I struggle with that big time because I'm kind of like prophetic in a lot of ways, you know? I like to bring the hammer down. So I'm like, that's not true, Mark Wahlberg, you know, or whatever. Is that the prayed up? Is that, you know what Mark Wahlberg does? Yeah, prayed up. Anyway, and Christian nationalism, all I mean to say about that is that's a real nebulous term. People tend to mean what they want it to mean, you know? What I think we have to be careful is to remember that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, right? Big America guy here. You know what I mean? Like, big America guy. Like, if I have water skis, I do sparklers and water skis on the 4th of July, you know? American flag trunks. Trunks. I'm all in. Love America, you know? Big patriot. But bigger Christian, okay? And not a like, Christians should never do anything in politics, yada, yada. I'm not one of these guys. Do I think that there are people on the left who overuse the term Christian nationalist? Yeah. I think I know people that call me a Christian nationalist. It's like when I worked at Brooks Brothers, you know, and whatnot. I was with a bunch of guys that were Catholic, and I said in passing, like, I'm not a fundamentalist like that, you know, and everybody busted out laughing, you know. They're like, yes, you are. What else would you be? And so, somebody out there would say that. All I mean to say is, man, I love America so much that I want to love Jesus more so that the gospel's clear for Americans. And when I think you put them together and you mix them together, you wind up with major, major, major problems. Big, big problems. Jesus' kingdom is not this world. God had a theocracy. Okay? And he had it. And guess what happened? They got carted off for their unfaithfulness, right? There's a new way to know and serve and love God, and that's through salvation through Jesus. That's what I'm here to preach. And I hope that the salt and light of Christianity continues to work its way through America, that we all may live long and prosper. I love it, right? But I want to be careful not to mix those things up. And what do I get for it? Everybody to vote for some other dude. I don't care. I want people to vote. Go vote. Vote your morality. Vote your Christian ideals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm here to talk about to preach Jesus. All right. Love y'all. Bye.